the Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here on case 2014-942, State of Ohio versus John Walker. For the appellant, Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Christopher Schroeder on behalf of the appellant, the State of Ohio. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are here asking this court to reverse the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals overturning DeJohn Walker's conviction for aggravated murder based on the lower court's belief that there was insufficient evidence to show that Walker killed Antoine Shannon with prior calculation and design. This is the sixth such case to come out of that court in the last 3 years. Those cases represent an ongoing trend whereby the court has expanded and distorted the test for sufficiency of the evidence. A sufficiency challenge, when properly considered, requires the appellate court to draw all reasonable inferences in favor of sustaining the jury's verdict. In the case of a conviction, that would mean viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state's case. Instead, the 8th District in this case made whatever inferences it found the most persuasive, viewed the evidence in the light that it believed the jury should have viewed it, and then reversed its conviction based upon its disagreement with the jury's verdict. And the best example of how the court did that is in its treatment of Walker's withdrawal from the attack. DeJohn Walker was part of a 6-on-1 attack against two men inside a nightclub. It began when a member of Walker's group, who was later identified as Robert Steele, struck Ivor Anderson in the head from behind, unprovoked, with a champagne bottle. Walker and the other 5 members of the group then joined in the attack. Walker walked up to the murder victim, Antoine Shannon, again unprovoked, and struck Shannon in the face with a champagne bottle. Shannon recoiled and ducked away to his left. Walker then threw the bottle at him, missing him and hitting a man standing behind him. Then he tackled Shannon to the ground. He then got up off of Shannon, left the attack, walked over to his left behind a pillar, visibly withdrawing a gun from his waistband on the camera as he did so. He then lay in wait behind that pillar as the other 5 members of the group continued the attack. Once Shannon turned his back to him, trying to restrain another member of the group from attacking Ivor Anderson, he shot Shannon once in the back, killing him. So DeJohn Walker voluntarily withdrew from the attack in this case to give himself an opportunity to pull the gun out of his waistband and wait for a clear shot.
Counsel, what's the time lapse between the initial hitting with the bottle and the shooting?
I believe it's 42 seconds, Your Honor. The initial strike occurs at 2:11 a.m., and I think 52 seconds is on the clock at that point. And then the actual gunshot, I think, occurs at 28 seconds past 2:12, if I have my math correctly there, maybe a little bit later. But I believe it's about 40 or 42 seconds that lapses over that entire time.
And during that period of time, there's a melee occurring on the dance floor.
Correct. It's a 6-on-1 attack. Yes, it could be called a melee. Yes, that's going on. The attack goes from one side of the room to the other several times. It's basically 5 people beating Ivor Anderson as he's on the ground trying to defend himself, and DeJohn Walker, for whatever reason, pursuing Antoine Shannon, striking him with the bottle, throwing it at him, and then tackling him to the ground.
But Antoine Shannon was not the intended victim?
He was with Ivor Anderson that night. They were friends. They were standing together, and there's testimony from Ivor Anderson that after the initial altercation in which Robert Steele spilled champagne onto Anderson, he asked Shannon to watch his back because he didn't want to get attacked with his back turned. So then there's sort of a long standoff between these two groups where Walker's group is directly in the middle of the camera, and they're looking and they're gesturing towards Anderson and Shannon, who are clearly standing together. I mean, you could tell that they're in this club, that they're together as part of a group, and they're talking to one another. So whether the intended target was Ivor Anderson or Antoine Shannon, I think it was both of them. I think the primary target was Ivor Anderson.
And Ivor Anderson was the one that was getting beat up by the 5 men at the time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Shannon comes in and tries to break up the altercation or at least protect.
Yes, Your Honor. He acts as a peacekeeper. He, at the moment that he's shot, he has one of Walker's group, Otis Johnson, who's the very large man with the dreadlocks, wrapped up in a bear hug from behind, and that's when he is actually shot. And that's very similar to what this court found in State versus Robbins, that the defendant's withdrawal from an attack to procure a weapon that he later uses to kill the victim is sufficient evidence of prior calculation and design. And the reason for that is that that indicates a sufficient cooling off period.
The Mr. Schroeder, the point here is this: the 8th District affirmed the murder conviction, felonious assault conviction, having a weapon while under disability. So your focus is on the meaning of prior calculation and design, isn't it?
That's what's disputed in this case. That's the only issue that's left alive at this point, yes, Your Honor, is whether there was prior calculation and design for this murder. The issue in this case is the 8th District's application of the sufficiency test to that prior calculation and design, since everything else has been affirmed.
So when you started out by talking about what the 8th District did here with respect to the jury verdict, that's not quite accurate, because in essence the court affirmed what the jury did on all of those other convictions. And your focus here is solely on the meaning of the words prior calculation and design.
The focus on what we're talking about today is on prior calculation and design. The 8th District did disregard the jury's verdict on the element of prior calculation and design. It wasn't waived to the bench. It was something that was found by the jury. And the court owes the same level of deference to that it would owe to any other count or element in the indictment.
So actual finding, or is it a question of law? Because sufficiency is a question of law determined generally by courts, but facts are going to a different standard, manifest weight. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a great difference between sufficiency and manifest weight. And the issue
here is your argument sufficiency or manifest weight?
It is sufficiency, because the court reversed under a sufficiency analysis. Had they done what they did in this case under a manifest weight analysis, where they are sitting as a 13th juror, they could have made factual findings contrary to what the jury found. For example.
So now they weighed sufficiency and said it's lacking. So we're here for us to reweigh the sufficiency question, right?
No, I'm not asking you to reweigh the sufficiency question. I'm asking you to refine or correct, in this case, the application of the sufficiency test here. Because what happened in this case was that the 8th District weighed witness credibility. It disregarded witness testimony, specifically the testimony of Ivor Anderson, that he believed Walker's group was planning to attack him. It made inferences that were not only not supported by the record, but they were not even asked by the defense in this case to be made, either at the trial court or in the Court of Appeals. For example, the court found that they called it a fight. The fight inadvertently spilled over in the direction of where Walker was standing. Not only is that not true, it didn't inadvertently spill over, it's an argument that no one in this case ever made prior to the 8th District making it itself. And that's beyond the scope of a sufficiency analysis. If we were under a manifest weight standard, where the court sits as a 13th juror, it could have potentially looked at that evidence and said, we just don't accept that version of events is true. We don't credit Ivor Anderson's testimony. Now, it would have to be an extraordinary case under the test for manifest weight, but it could do that.
So is this an abuse of discretion by the Court of Appeals in failing to follow the definition of sufficiency and drawing inferences favorable to the state and making its own? Is that the problem?
It is the problem. I don't believe that you're reviewing for an abuse of discretion standard here, because the sufficiency question shouldn't be a question of fact. It should be a question of law. The 8th District sort of commingled these two ideas by bringing in and making disputes of fact where no previous disputes of fact existed.
So, counsel, you want us to reset or reiterate what the test for sufficiency of the evidence should be upon an appellate review, and then remand it with instructions to the 8th District to follow the parameters of our test?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like you to hold it in a sufficiency.
Counsel, before you answer that, let me interrupt. Chief, I have to interrupt for a second. I have a summer cold, and I don't want to interrupt your argument by my coughing. So I'm going to go into our chambers. I'll be with you. You just won't see me.
Very good, Your Honor. I would like this court to hold that in a sufficiency review, the appellate court may not consider and rely upon inferences favorable to the defendant or that the defendant asks the court to draw to justify or rely on overturning a conviction.
Yeah, they have to support or give the in the light most favorable to the jury verdict.
Yes,
that's
Your
what
Honor.
You're asking us to do. And that's you think that's the missing component in the activity of the 8th District Court of Appeals?
In this case, yes, because if this decision is allowed to stand, it becomes binding precedent for all future cases in Cuyahoga County, all 34 common pleas.
And you said that this is a pattern that you've seen in the 8th District. Explain what you mean by that.
There are six cases since the beginning of 2013, six aggravated murder cases that the 8th District has reversed for a lack of prior calculation and design.
And I cite those. One was a companion to Walker?
Yes. Yes, one was this case, and one was Darrell Shabazz, the co-defendant case, which we argued in this court 14 months ago that you dismissed as improvidently allowed in March. Those are two of the six. And three of those six have happened since the decision in the Walker and Shabazz cases. Those came out on the same day. So this is an ongoing trend, and it's actually an accelerating trend because we've had three
well,
so far.
Well, is it also possible that the 8th District thinks that the prosecutor's office is overcharging and bringing cases consistently that don't have prior calculation and design?
That seems to be what they do think, Your Honor, but I would submit to this court and I in the brief.
How many cases in this period of time that you're talking about where you feel the 8th District has gone awry, how many cases are in that universe?
In the entire rest of the state of Ohio over
there.
Oh, that.
In Cuyahoga County, you said six. Six out of how many?
Out of how many aggravated murder cases that they've considered, I do not know.
Well, wouldn't that, you know, to set a pattern, wouldn't that be, you know, we've had 15 and six of them have been, the 8th District has gone the way that they have in Walker? Or, I mean, to say that there's a pattern.
I think you can say that there's a pattern by looking at the entire rest of the state. In the entire rest of the state of Ohio, at the time we filed the briefs, there had only been one other aggravated murder case, and the other 87 counties reversed for a lack of prior calculation and design under a sufficiency review.
Well, but your office is not practicing in those other 87 counties.
Correct, Your Honor, and the 8th District clearly is not on the same page as we are with regard to what constitutes prior calculation and design, but they also seem not to be on the same page as the other 11 appellate districts in the state, which virtually never reversed these things. Since then, there's been a second case that was reversed in Franklin County 3 weeks ago. That's an unusual case where the court said that transferred intent cannot apply to prior calculation and design. But in this particular case, the reason that this is important is because this pattern becomes the standard by which we are held in all future cases.
Counsel, do you agree that the prior calculation and design test is set forth in Cassano and Cotton and D'Ambrosio?
It is. There is no bright line test for what constitutes prior calculation and design.
And that's what the 8th District said in its analysis, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has identified factors in the past that are relevant to the consideration of prior calculation and design. However, the court misapplied even those factors in this case. For example, at one point the court says that Walker did not choose the murder weapon and did not choose the murder site. And that's simply not true. And it's certainly not true under a sufficiency analysis. He chose to bring a gun with him to the club that night. He cycles through weapons even during the attack. He starts
the prior calculation and design. We've said that it's more than a few moments of deliberation permitted, and it's to require a scheme designed to implement calculated design to kill. So factors such as whether the persons knew each other, was the act drawn out, and so on, those are issues that the court also took into account, correct?
It did. Yes, and I would also point out that this court held in State versus Pierce that no definitive period of time must elapse and no particular amount of consideration must be given to the prior calculation and design to kill. I would refer this court to two of its prior precedents, both of which I think the prior calculation and design is less in those cases than it is here.
Have we ever had a bar fight that turned out to have a prior calculation and design?
Yes, State versus Taylor, which is cited extensively in the briefs. It's the case that actually gives us those three factors that I talked about.
And that's the case that you would say is most like this one?
Most like this one, yes. The two cases that I was going to cite that I think are show how little time can be required for prior calculation and design would be State versus Donald Palmer, which is a road rage shooting where the defendant gets out of his car and shoots two men on the side of the road, and this court held that just the amount of time it took the defendant to cock his revolver to convert it into a single action was sufficient prior calc. And the second case is State versus Goodwin, where Chief Justice Moyer held that the act of placing a gun to the head of the victim is itself evidence of prior calculation and design because it indicates the defendant, prior to pulling the trigger, has made the calculated decision to kill, hence why he points the gun at his head. I see
counsel, the companion case that we dismissed about Shabazz. He was not the shooter.
Correct.
He was also charged with prior calculation and design, correct?
He was, yes.
Okay. Because of his relationship with Mr. Walker being involved in the same bar fight?
He was charged under a theory of complicity, Your Honor. There was in the trial court, both defendants claimed that they didn't do it. On appeal, that there was not much of a dispute that Walker was the shooter and that Shabazz was the accomplice.
But you're saying that there was evidence that they whispered together and then the fight breaks out and then Walker retreats to pull the gun out, and you think that his co-defendant there was aware that he was going to use a gun to kill Mr. Shannon?
That was our argument in the Shabazz case, and I understand that ship has sailed at this point, but the argument in Shabazz is that these two men and the others in their group are standing together in this group on the middle of the floor for 15 minutes. They're talking, they're gesturing in the direction of Anderson and Shannon. Shabazz takes his glasses off. They're holding bottles as weapons. They turn them upside down so that they're cradling them in their arms as weapons. They fan out to surround them, and then the attack begins. After the gunshot goes off, when Walker shoots Shannon, it happens almost right in Shabazz's face. He's standing closer to the gunshot than I am to you. He shows no reaction to the gunshot whatsoever. Instead, he walks over to where Walker is coming out from the other side of the pole, and he pats him on the chest, and he pats him on the back, and then the two men flee the club together. So the argument there is that Shabazz acted at all times as somebody who knew that the shot was coming before, during, and after, and that was enough to sustain a conviction for complicity to aggravated murder.
Can you tell me the difference between purposeful killing and killing with prior calculation and design? Because to me, from what you're saying, it sounds that you're conflating the two.
The difference in this case would be whether the act was spontaneous or an almost spontaneous eruption of events, or whether the act was drawn out in some way. It's what this court talked about in the Taylor case. So, for example, had Mr. Walker pulled out the gun and shot Shannon in the middle of this attack, you could make a strong argument, I think a much stronger argument than the defendant has here, that was a spontaneous thing, that in the middle of this attack, the heat of the moment caught up to him, and he pulled out the gun and shot him. But where he withdraws from the attack, goes and waits behind the pillar, pulls out the gun, and lies in wait for an opportunity to shoot this man in the back, that's not something that's done on the spur of the moment. He gave himself a cooling off period. He gave himself time to think about it. He gave himself time to plan what he was going to do next. It takes planning to move to that vantage point where no one can see you, where Shannon cannot.
But why Shannon and not the original instigator by, you know, the fellow that spilled the drink and was the first recipient of the champagne bottle, right?
Correct. Ivor Anderson, yes.
Yes. Why not Anderson? Why Shannon?
The simple answer to that is that I don't know, but for whatever reason, DeJean Walker immediately at the beginning of the fight focuses in on Antoine Shannon, and that's the only person during the entire attack that he ever shows any aggression towards. So whatever his reason was, that is clearly what he was doing. He was clearly attacking Antoine Shannon. There was an issue in the Shabazz case in Justice O'Donnell's dissent from the order dismissing it as improvidently allowed, where there's an issue of transferred intent, that even if he was intending to shoot Ivor Anderson, that the intent could transfer to Antoine Shannon under this court's decision in State versus Soul. Ultimately, I don't think that's outcome determinative either way, because whether he intended to shoot Shannon or he intended to shoot Anderson, there is still prior calculation and design. But I think the more plausible way of looking at what happened in this case is that he walks behind the pillar, having already used bottles and used fists to attack Antoine Shannon, that he then walks away intending to use a gun to finish the job, a weapon capable of producing death.
Are you asking us to clarify the sufficiency standard, and then if we reverse the judgment of the appellate court in that regard, does it go back to the appellate court, or how do you see the resolution of this from your vantage point?
Ideally, I'd like this court to adopt the language of the 11th District in Byerly, that a Rule 29 or a sufficiency challenge should only be sustained where there's no need for formal deliberation at all in the case, because a verdict of acquittal should be a foregone conclusion. I think if you adopt that test, that language from the Byerly case, that this becomes a relatively simple matter. The jury in this case, the judge at Rule 29, and one member of the Court of Appeals panel on the Shabazz case all believed that there was sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction for aggravated murder.
So am I misunderstanding you there, that you think the Court of Appeals can only apply this where they're looking at it and say that the judge should not have even left this go to the jury?
That is what the Court of Appeals said, because this court has said...
That's your standard on this.
This court has previously said that the standard for granting a Rule 29 is the same as the standard for a sufficiency challenge on appeal. So if the Court of Appeals says that there was insufficient evidence, then they are, in effect, saying the same thing as this case should never have gone to the jury on this element. And it did go to the jury. The judge thought it was enough to go to the jury. 12 jurors thought it was proof beyond reasonable.
If it gets to the jury, Court of Appeals shouldn't be looking at it at all?
No, they absolutely should look at it. And if the evidence is insufficient, it's their job to overrule that conviction. But in this case, what they cannot do is to rely on facts that are not in the record, rely on evaluations of witness credibility, disregard witness testimony, draw inferences that are favorable to the defendant that are never asked to be drawn at any point in the proceeding. It can't do those things because that's beyond the scope of a sufficiency review.
So thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Bensing.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Russ Bensing. I'm here on behalf of DeJohn Walker. This case isn't about the test for sufficiency of the evidence. The Eighth District cited that test. The question, and that's been the law in Ohio for 20 years or more, there's no need to clarify that test. This case is about whether the state proved prior calculation and design sufficiently so that a jury verdict could be based upon it. And they have presented two theories by which they claim they did that. The first is the theory that they've advanced all through this litigation, that these people were planning for 15 minutes to kill Antoine Shannon, or Ivor Anderson. The second is the theory that they pretty much advanced today, that the 22 seconds, not 42 seconds, in response to your question, Chief Justice, there was 42 seconds between the time that Steele hit Anderson over the head with the champagne bottle and the shooting. The time between when Anderson was wrestling with Walker and Walker got up off the floor, went around and shot him was a matter of 22 seconds. So that's what we're talking about here.
Counsel, aren't we also talking about the 15-minute period?
Absolutely. That is what the state has argued here. And the entirety of the evidence in support of that theory in 1,324 pages of transcript is the 53 words of the testimony of Ivor Anderson found on pages 693 to 694. After the champagne was spilled onto me, he went over and whispered to the two gentlemen, and at that point I continued to watch the gentlemen because there wasn't nothing that serious to take it that far, I felt at that point they were plotting against me and Mr. Shannon. That's it.
Didn't they also see the videos?
They saw the videos, and on the videos, the state points out that there were two occasions when they claim that the group gestured in the direction of Shannon and Anderson, and several times where they looked in the direction of Shannon and Anderson. The problem with that is these are not two isolated groups. This is a bar. This is a crowded bar. When you say you looked in their direction, if I'm looking at the court, I'm looking in your direction. If I turn back here and gesture back there, you have no idea who I'm gesturing toward.
Well, yeah, all right, but the same group that is, in the words of Mr. Anderson, conspiring, turns out to attack Mr. Anderson and Mr. Shannon. So it's not it's not a huge leap to figure out that these five men were, in fact, targeting Anderson.
And I think that's where the state's case completely falls down, because if you look at the video at the precise moment that Steele sprints about 15 feet away from the group and hits Anderson over the head with a champagne bottle, Dejon Walker and Shabazz are looking in a different direction. And even then, they turn, they see the melee, and that's when they join in. If they had been planning this all along, the state tries to make it sound like this was a planned, coordinated attack. It's not. They're not even looking in the direction of the attack when it's
Is that
struck.
A requirement that if you're going to be involved, you got to be looking in that direction? You can't be looking to see if there's anybody that's also looking or, you know, possibly going to come and interfere with your plan?
Well, I don't think that's what
I mean,
they
I don't see that as being conclusive of anything.
Well, I think it's conclusive of the fact that they weren't planning to attack because they didn't participate in the attack. If you're going to say that you're planning an attack and you're planning a coordinated attack, and at the time the coordinated attack takes place, two people are looking in a different direction and don't participate in the coordinated attack, I think you have a problem. Plus, you have the fact that this is a plan. If it was a plan, it was a plan to engage in a bar fight. It wasn't a plan to kill Antoine Shannon or Ivor
so
Anderson.
So why did your client pull out a gun?
That's when he formulated the intent to kill.
Why?
So that takes us to the second question, and that is whether the 22 seconds are sufficient to show.
No, my question is why did he shoot him?
Why did he shoot him? Because he got upset during the fight. He got knocked down. That's when he decided he couldn't stop him with a champagne bottle or punching him.
So he figured he better use something more than a champagne bottle.
That's correct.
And so he formulates the plan. Oh, I remember, I've got a gun in my pocket. I think I'll pull that out and kill him.
Well, he formulated the intent. Now, the question is whether that 22 seconds is sufficient to show prior calculation and design. And I think here the state's problem is that they believe that the difference between prior calculation and design and premeditation is a quantitative one, that if it only takes a matter of seconds for premeditation, then anything more than a matter of seconds is sufficient to show prior calculation and design.
Do you have a time limit on what has to...
No, I don't...
There is no time limit, right?
I don't think there is a time
limit.
It
could be seconds.
Well, I don't think it can be seconds. I don't think any court decision in this, any decision by this court shows that it can be a matter of seconds, because that's a test for premeditation. I think if you look at the history of these court's decisions, you look at the legislative history, you need more than that. There's a qualitative difference. If you look at the Legislative Service Commission, the phrase prior calculation and design was employed to indicate studied care in planning and analyzing the means of the crime, as well as a scheme encompassing the death of the victim. In Palmer and in the other case that the state cited, Goodwin. Yeah, that was a totally different situation. In Palmer, it wasn't so much that the guy pulled out a gun and shot two people. He shot one person, and then another guy drove up, got out, and he shot him as well. So that there was some planning and design involved there. And in Goodwin, the situation was the guy goes in, shoots the clerk in the head, and he argued that it was accidental. The court looked at the video of it and said, no, this isn't accidental. This was part of your plan for the robbery. You were going to kill somebody to get the other clerk to comply.
But in Palmer, you say that there were two shootings, right?
Yes.
And they're obviously two different people in two different vehicles.
Yes.
And that sustained prior calculation and design.
You held in that case that that was sufficient to show prior calculation.
Okay, he shoots the first person because of a road rage incident, right?
Yes, he gets
somebody
out
else comes up. And he shoots him as well.
That's correct. He pulls up, gets out of his...
I mean, if that was sufficient for prior calculation and design, the shooter didn't know that another person was going to come up, but he still shot him when he did show up.
Yeah, he did shoot him when he did show up, but I think there the court held that the two killings, which were, you know, that they weren't... part of the same incident, showed a plan to kill. He intended to kill the person he shot, and he intended to kill anybody who came in and was a potential witness
and
to
here,
the crime.
And here, Walker intended to kill Anderson. I mean, excuse me, Shannon.
There's no question about that. He intended to kill him.
But how about the fact that he came there armed? Where's that impact?
I don't think it has any impact whatsoever because he didn't, if he had come there armed, as in the case, one of the cases, I believe it was Alexander, where the guy goes to the bar, mm-hmm. I think Alexander was actually the victim, he goes to the bar with a gun and he had had a strained relationship. He knew that the victim was going to be in the bar. There, I think, if there had been knowledge that, if Walker had knowledge that Shannon was going to be at this bar and he took the gun along, there had been evidence of a strained relationship between him and Shannon, then I think that's clearly evidence of prior calculation and design.
And counsel, isn't that what we're talking about, the difference between murder, which is purposeful killing, and aggravated murder, which has the prior calculation
that's
and
exactly,
design? Would you agree that some of the past cases have seemed to conflate the two?
Well, I think... to a certain extent, as you said in Taylor and in other cases, this isn't a bright line test that you get into here. And I think in certain cases, simply the heinousness of the crime, as with a clerk in Goodwin, it can tilt the balance here.
But what we're talking here is telling the jury, and we're talking a sufficiency, telling the jury that there's enough evidence here that it takes it out of the purposeful killing
and moves
into
it up.
The aggravated murder of prior calculation and design. And this is where, if we were to affirm the Eighth District, we would be saying the trial court should never have given the jury the aggravated murder because there was insufficient evidence
that
of prior
correct.
Calculation and design.
That would be the
design.
Proper test for it. Sufficiency okay. if the evidence on appellate review is the same as you use at the trial level on a 29A.
So you're saying we need not disturb our definitions of sufficiency
no.
and
no.
so on?
I don't think this case has anything to do with insufficiency of the evidence or the standard for that. That's clear. The Eighth District applied that. The question is whether they applied it correctly in light of the facts of this case. And one thing I'd emphasize here, this isn't Shabazz where somebody is walking out from under a murder charge. Mr. Walker was convicted of murder. The only consequence of this court's decision will be whether he hits the parole board in 20 years or 25. And considering that the parole board is releasing about 6% of the people that it conducts hearings for.
In this case, the case does have consequences for future cases.
Oh, it definitely does.
For example, I think I'm going to see whether we can agree. Don't you think the 8th District took some liberties when they're reviewing the Jenkins factors, for example, in choosing the site when they said that the murder site came to him?
Well, I
are we,
think
are we
going
to define a murder site as 4 square feet or 400 square feet?
Well, I think what the evidence showed in this case, and I think the state was trying to argue that the other people moved Shannon to the murder site, moved him into position for Walker to shoot him, and the 8th District, in response to that, said there was no way that was actually, it could have just as easily moved in the other direction, and I think if you look at the videotape, that's absolutely true. If you can find any coordinated effort to move anybody anywhere.
No, I understand
anywhere,
that, but if we're talking about reversing on sufficiency of the evidence, and we're required to construe the evidence most favorable to the state.
Yes, you are.
Can you really support the statement by the 8th District saying rather the video shows that the murder site came to him? Is that really fair?
Well, I think in the sense that, yes, Shannon did move toward where Walker was. Walker gets up, pulls out a gun, walks a few feet, has a clear shot, takes it. That's what happened in this case. This isn't a situation that I think the state makes reference to him hiding behind a pillar out of view of the cameras. He doesn't know where the cameras are. He doesn't know if there are cameras in there. And if you look at the
How
video,
do you know that?
What?
How do you know that? Did
I
he
don't.
Testify to that?
No, he didn't testify at all. But
okay, wait a second. You just said, you attributed to your client's state of mind, he didn't know whether a camera's there, he didn't know where the camera's there, he didn't even know if a camera was in the room.
I apologize.
You have no basis to say that.
I think the better statement would have been there was no evidence to show that he knew where the cameras were or whether he knew there were cameras in the place. That's what the state contended. The state was contending he moved out of view of the cameras. If they're contending that,
well, that is true. He did move out of the view of the cameras.
Well, but again, if you
behind
look,
a pillar.
But they claimed he was doing that to avoid detection. And if you look at the videotape, you see plenty of other people behind the pillar. He's not moving out of anybody's view except the camera. And the state introduced no evidence that he knew where those cameras were, that he knew there were cameras. So I don't think you can make an inference from that he was trying to avoid detection, which is the inference that the state is trying to draw. And that's the problem with this case. Time after time, you have speculation as a substitute for evidence. Shannon says, I think they were plotting against me. What's his evidence of that? Does he say, yes, they were pointing at me. They were giving me dirty looks. They were gesturing toward me. They were saying things to me. He doesn't say any of that. He says that Steele walked over and whispered to two people, neither of which was DeJohn Walker, and that's his entire basis for believing that they were plotting against him.
Except for the fact that they followed through and had an attack on him.
That's the correct. They did follow through and have an attack on him, and I think that probably what he was doing was retroactively figuring that they were planning that out during that time. And as I said, the evidence that Walker was involved in that planning is non-existent. He was looking in a different direction when the fight broke out. He didn't participate in it from the get-go. So I think that what we have here, this is a difficult the situation because I think the state is asking you to enunciate a standard of law here, and you're really not going to be able to do that here. What you're really being asked to do is enunciate a standard for prior calculation and design. And you have said repeatedly there is no bright line for determining that. And you can't draw a bright line in this case. You can't say, well, 22 seconds is enough. You can't say 15 seconds is enough.
Would it help for us to define it differently than purpose? Purposeful.
I think the case law and the legislature has defined it differently from purposeful, and I think that's a very important distinction.
But keep getting at. It seems like in the past cases, if it was done with intent, we're saying there's a possibility that it was automatically prior calculation and design, so that the two don't seem to be separate elements, one raising it to an aggravated murder, with the other one staying murder.
Yeah, I think that really the test here is the one that you laid out in Taylor. You look at it and determine whether there is a strained relationship between the people, whether there was some forethought put into planning on the weapon, choosing the weapon, and choosing the site of the crime. Those are the critical factors here, and they're not present in this case. So like I said, what you're basically being asked to do is come up with a bright line test, which is impossible, and apply it to this case. And you can't do that. I don't think that the evidence here was sufficient to show prior calculation and design. You had maybe prior calculation and design to engage in a bar fight. That's the most that you can say of this evidence, and you have to engage in speculation to do that. You have to buy into Anderson's testimony that he saw two people whispering and therefore they must have been plotting for the next 15 minutes. And of course, he gives that testimony after the attack. And it's certainly obvious, it's certainly understandable that in retrospect he would review that in terms of, well, the people must have been planning the attack because they carried it out. But there's no evidence to support the planning. It's pure speculation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. The distinction between purposeful murder and prior calculation and design is not a bright line test, as this court has said. You can draw that distinction based upon the facts of this case, and where that line is drawn is where Walker withdraws from the fight. If he had pulled out a gun in the middle of the fight and shot the victim to death, that would be purposeful murder. There would be no evidence of any kind of a plan there to conceive, to execute a preconceived plan to kill. But when he leaves the attack, when he withdraws, where he stops using bottles and stops using fists and pulls out a gun instead, that becomes prior calculation and design, because there's no other conceivable reason for him to leave the attack, walk behind that pillar, already drawing his gun. He's already conceived the intent to kill, and he's going to execute that intent to kill by moving to a safe vantage point. It's not about being out of the way of the cameras. It's about being out of the way of other people seeing him. That's why he does that. There's no other reason, and especially in a sufficiency analysis, when you look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, the only way to look at that evidence is that he has already formed the intent to kill at the point where he walks away from the attack, which is 22 seconds before the gunshot even goes off, and that's plenty of time to execute a preconceived plan to kill. I'd ask this court to reverse the decision of the 8th District.
Counsel, I want to make sure I understand your position. All aggravated murder convictions must be a purposeful murder, correct?
If they're charged under subsection A, well, even if they're charged under subsection B, it would have to be a purposeful murder in the commission of a felony. So yes, they would all have to be purposeful murders.
You cannot have aggravated murder without purposeful murder.
Correct. Okay. Correct. And that's what we have in this case, is an ag murder, a purposeful murder committed with prior calculation and design, which is why it was indicted under subsection A of the statute. So I'd ask this court to reverse the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.